So, good evening. We are looking at the concept. I think the title, if you're standing still, what did you call it?
I said, is standing still the same as going backwards? A Hasidic perspective.
Okay. I think we'll begin with a Talmudic perspective, and then we'll move into a Hasidic perspective. Or maybe the Talmudic perspective and the Hasidic perspective are the same. So we're looking here at a passage in Chagigah. Chagigah is a very beautiful Masechta. Just to begin with a little story about Chagigah, which is told in a book called Sefer Chassidim. Sefer Chassidim, Book of the Pious, was written something like the 13th century in Ashkenaz, in the same sort of area as Rashi and the Baalei HaTosafot. And so it tells the story there of a person who lived in a little town, and he only studied one Masechta Talmud, and that was Masechta Chagigah. So he would learn this Masechta when he got to the end. It's not terribly long. When he got to the end, he would begin again from the beginning. And that was what he learned. He didn't go into any other Masechta. That was what he learned. Years and years went by. And then, unfortunately, he got ill and he passed away. Now, unfortunately, he didn't have any family. And no wife, no children, no brothers, sisters, no one knew anything about him. And it was just a very small levaya, a very small funeral, the Chevra Kedishin. And a week or two later, people were surprised that there was a woman in black who was seen at his gravesite. Who was the woman in black? So the Chacham of the town, the Chacham, that's how Sefer Chassidim phrases itself, the sage, had a dream. And it was revealed to him in the dream that this woman in black was Masechta Chagigah, the tractate Chagigah, which had come to mourn for the person who had studied her so assiduously. So that's a little insight into Masechta Chagigah. It's a very special tractate. In the second perek of Chagigah, it's Ein Doshin. It's all about Maaseh Merkava, the mystical secrets of Torah, very special work. But here we're in Perek Rishon. So we're on this page, which is 9 Omud Beis, Tes Omud Beis. If we look 3 lines down in the middle of the line, my dichtiv, what is it which is written, v'shavtem ure'item ben tzadik l'rasha, you will turn back and you will see the difference between a tzaddik and a rasha. Bein oved elekim, the difference between oved elekim, one who serves God, la'asher lo avodo, and someone who doesn't serve God. All right, so that's the verse. So the Gemara asks, hainu tzaddik, hainu oved elekim. If you say tzaddik, that's the same as the one who serves God. Hainu rasha, hainu asher lo avodo. And the Rosha is the same as the one who doesn't serve God. Why does the verse have to repeat itself? All it should say is, you should turn back and see the difference between a tzaddik and a Rosha, or between one who serves God and one who doesn't serve God. Why does it repeat the terminology? Amalei said to him, avodo v'lo avodo, you know what? The word, the concept, he's serving God and not serving God, they aren't Rishoyim. Tavayu tzadiki gemuri ninhu. They are both complete tzadikim. Amazing concept. Okay, let's just see the Rashi, which is on the inside, the right-hand side. Hainu tzadik, hainu oved elokim. Miu tzadik and miu oved elokim. Halo yechad hu. Who is the tzaddik? Who is the one who serves God? They're both the same, surely. So it's now explaining that both these qualities are actually the same. But serving God and not serving God are both of them at tzaddikim. The only thing is, you can't compare someone. Now, in their time, when they used to learn Mishnayos, they would learn a Perek Mishnayos, and they would say the Perek over 100 times. There's a theory, that's one of the reasons why it's called Mishnah, because Shana means to repeat. Or Tana, also a Tana of the Mishnah, because they would repeat it again and again till they knew it absolutely by heart. That's why when they come to discuss the Mishnayos in the Gemara, they can say, how can our Mishnah says this, but in another Mishnah it says that, because they know the whole thing by heart. So it's saying, you can't compare someone who says over his Mishnah 100 times to someone who says it over 101 times. In other words, what it's implying, let's just see Rashi. Even though both of them are tzaddikim, which we'll have to consider, what does that mean, they're both tzaddikim? They didn't serve God in the same way. Because the one who says it 101 times, he serves God more. So in compared with the other one, he's described as someone who doesn't serve God. And Omalei, so he says to him, Umishum chad zimna krile lo yavodoi, because of one time you say that he didn't serve God. He said it over 100 times. Surely that's pretty good service of God. And just because the other guy said it 101 times make him so much better? Omalei in, he said, yes. Tzeil amad mishuk shol chamorim. Look at the donkey taxi rank. You want to have some stuff, or you want to take a taxi somewhere, you want to take the donkey on a journey. Asara pasi bezuza. If you're going 10 Persian miles, it's a zuz. Chadasa pasi, but if you're going 11 Persian miles, just one more, betray zuzi. It's twice. It's twice as much. Now that is a very interesting concept in the Gemara, and there aren't actually any Tosfos on this. So now let's look in a chapter, Tanya.
Can I just say what's coming up for me in the Rashi?
Yeah.
Is where the Gemara doesn't say anything more. Rashi's kind of softens the Gemara and saying, yes, they both serve Hashem, but one has done better than the other.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas from the Gemara itself doesn't say it's a kind of relative piece. It doesn't soften the blow, so to speak. Rashi softens the blow.
That's a very good point, Saul.
Yeah.
That is a very good point. And I think we'll find that the way the Tanya goes...
So I'm confused why they're both tzaddikim then.
Right. How do you define a tzaddik?
Yeah.
Well... it becomes more clear in Tanya, but you could define a person as a tzaddik if they never actually do anything wrong. And that all the duties that they're supposed to do, they carry out. So if someone does everything he's supposed to do and never does anything wrong, so in normal parlance, that's a tzaddik. The special Chabad speak, which is there in Tanya that we'll find, he uses a different term. But the idea of a person doesn't do anything wrong, doesn't break a single commandment, and he does everything he's supposed to do. The only thing is, but when it comes to, in this case, learning Mishnayos, he does what he's supposed to do 100 times.
But then, if that's what a tzaddik is, he does everything right, he doesn't do anything wrong, then he does serve God. He could perhaps serve more, go above and beyond, but if he's doing everything he's supposed to do, which God set him, then he is.
There's a very interesting concept. I think we get it in two rather disparate areas of life. One is sport and one is education. The modern approach to education and the general approach, probably also a kind of a modern approach to sport, is going the extra mile. Someone doesn't go the extra mile, then they're running very, very fast. You know, tremendous long jump. They haven't broken the limit. They haven't. They haven't got the cup. That's they're still within the limit, and yes. And the same in education. You know, you got a bright student; they got everything right. What's the teacher supposed to do? You're supposed to say, "Very good. Yes, you really analyzed this very, very well. Even better if." We even use like shorthand, EBI, even better if, because that's the thrust of the modern education concept, is you have to be teaching students to go the extra mile. So the person can be a tzaddik, wonderful, sitting on his laurels or her laurels, but going the extra mile, which in this case is saying the Perek Mishnah is another type, extra, more than anyone else does, more than someone else does. Now that, what it means more, could be a relative concept as well, that for each individual, you evaluate the way they are according to their situation. So here is a page of Gemara which we just finished. We'll actually come across it again, because it's going to be repeated in the Tanya. But here are a handout of Tanya chapter 15 of the first section of Tanya. Right.
So it feels like in the first instance of repeating 100 times, there's almost coasting to tick the box. Whereas the 101 is where the avodah is. The extra one, yeah. The exponential increase, doubling of the
yeah.
of the reward.
Yeah, the very fact that he goes the extra mile means a completely different attitude. That's the way it's said. It's interesting how modernistic it is. I actually taught this chapter, Tanya, earlier this week in the university, where we are doing a course on Hasidism and modernity in UCL. So the discussion is...
I go to UCL. How have I not heard about this?
Well, you can come and do a course unit with me. What course are you doing?
Computer science.
Well, in some courses, they allow you to do a module which is outside your subject, like in law, like psychology, I think it's students. Maybe in computer science, for another year.
I don't think that, yeah, maybe next year. I don't think I have the choice.
What year are you in?
First year.
Okay, so pretty limiting then. So I talk about modernistic elements in Hasidism, and we try to define what is modernity. So there are all kinds of interesting definitions of modernity. You know, one definition is brothers become others, the prophet motive. I heard someone say today a beautiful, Bruderschaft ist nicht Handelschaft, something like that. Brotherhood is not business. So you got to go, in order to make a profit, you got to go beyond brotherhood. Now Max Weber describes this, and he says it's shocking. Yeah, and that's the problem with modernity. He says you don't need technology to get people becoming losing their soul. You can have it in a very, very sort of quiet, sleepy environment, but they are working for profit rather than my grandfather did business with your grandfather, so you and I are going to go on doing business. No, I found a better supplier and I'm going to work with him, and all the links are broken. So that's described by Max Weber in his The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. So we're looking for modernistic elements in Hasidism. So one of the modernistic elements is dynamism, move, change, constant change. That's defined by a woman called Bernice Martin, Professor Bernice Martin, retired. She was a colleague of my wife in Royal Holloway University. And she wrote a book on contemporary cultural change, things like the Beatles. Fascinating book. So she talks about continuous change is the ethos of modernity. That's what defines it. And so where do you get change in Hasidism? Hasidism, traditional Judaism, the caricature of it is that it's always static. Everyone's trying to do what they did 100 years ago or 200 years ago. That's why they wear funny clothes and stuff like that. But in fact, so we learned this chapter, which talks about how you've always got to go the extra mile, you've always got to work. And so the dynamic element in Hasidic thought. All right. So Rabbi Shneur Zalman starts off by quoting the verse, Perek Tesvov, Ubaze Yuvan, and through this we'll understand, Ma shekatuv v'shavtem u'ra'item bein tzadik l'rasha, bein oved elokim l'asher lo avodo. You'll turn back and you'll see the difference between a tzaddik and a rasha, one who serves God and one who doesn't serve God. This was quoted in the Talmud, and then the Talmud gave its explanation, which in the Tanya is on the next page. He's got a whole Rabbi Shneur Zalman provides a kind of a whole explanation in between. First of all, he takes all of these terms as meaning something different. Shahefresh bein oved elokim letzadik. There is a difference. He sees a difference between the one serving God and the tzaddik. In the Talmud, it assumed that they're the same, but he sees a difference. What's the difference? Husha oved, the one who serves, hulashon hoved, it's in the present. Shehu be'emtza ha'aboda, he is in the middle of the service. Shehi ha'milchama im ha'yetzara, he is in the middle of the battle with the evil desire, lehitgaber alav, to conquer it, ulegarsho meha'ir ketana, and to drive it out. Now he uses this metaphor from the small city. The small city means the person himself. So it's as if we ourselves, each one of us, is like a little city, and there are two kings battling over the city. One king is the divine soul, and the other king is the animal soul. And so what's happening here is that he's in the middle of the struggle trying to deal with the animal soul, shelo yitlabesh be'evri aguf, that it, or the yetzahara. The yetzahara, the evil desire, is like the more negative aspect of the animal soul. Because in fact, we use the animal soul. Every time you eat food and you salivate, you're using the animal soul. If we really knock the animal soul out completely, it would be many aspects of life would be quite difficult to accomplish. So we need the animal soul in a certain level, but when it becomes more coarse and more demanding and more insistent, that's when it becomes not just animal soul, it becomes yetzahara. Now this is a very interesting nuancing of the Talmudic and Midrashic concept, yetzahara and yetzatov, which like they're very simple, black and white. The Yetzer Tov is good and the Yetzer Hara is bad. So in Chabad Hasidic thought, first of all, the Yetzer Hara has many gradations. You call it the animal soul, and so it's only at a certain point it becomes bad, and at another point you need it. You need it in order to eat and do other aspects of life. The competition which is there just in order to survive is something, even to learn Torah. Kinat sofrim tabe chokhma, the jealousy of scribes, of sage, of scholars, increases wisdom. To a certain extent, that's the animal soul. I'm going to understand this Tosfot before the other guy. I'm going to do a better chiddush. And also the Yetzer Tov is also nuanced in Chabad Hasidic thought. So in Tanya we don't find the nuancing of the divine soul, but in later Chabad writing, we find the statement that you can have a frum yetzahara and even a Hasidic yetzahara. So, but it's still yetzahara. That's the yetzahara, and then you can have the divine soul. But the divine soul also can be selfish in a sense. All right, now, so the battle is, the one who's called Oved Elokim is the one who's struggling. He's in the middle of the service. That's the battle with the Yetzer Hara to drive out the animal soul, the evil desire. Shelo yitlabesh be'evrei aguf, that it shouldn't be enclosed in the limbs of the body. In other words, controlling his body. Shehu be'emet avodah v'amal gadol. In fact, this is a very great effort. Lehilachem bo tamid, to battle with it all the time, v'hainu ha-beinani. Now that is the beinani. In Chabad speak, the beinani is the person who has got complete control somehow. How they manage to get this control is a very interesting question. But they've got complete control over their thought, speech and action, to the extent that they never transgress Torah, and they do everything they're supposed to do. So whatever, you know, the code of law says you're supposed to do, they do. And whatever it says you're not supposed to do, they don't do it. So they've ticked all the boxes, right? But
so they're like kind of the Mesilas Yesharim Tzaddik. They do everything, but they don't go Bitnim Meshura Sadin to reach a Chassid stage. Well, because that doesn't sound like much of a Beinoni to me. He's completely in control of his Yetzer Hara and he does everything he needs to do.
Well, you see, the interesting thing is, if we compare, shortly I'm supposed to give a talk comparing Mesilat Yesharim with Chabad thought. If we compare the concept of Rabbi Shneur Zalman's tzaddik, Rabbi Shneur Zalman's tzaddik has somehow, he's worked on his or her animal soul in such a way that the animal soul is no longer a problem. And there are two stages of that. One stage is that the animal soul is completely inert. Now, it's not so difficult to imagine such a situation. For example, imagine you go to the Kotel Maharavi, assuming there are no problems as there are nowadays, but you've gone to the Kotel Maharavi, and you're saying Tehillim or Davening Mincha, you know, whatever it is, you're inspired. At that moment, you're inspired. The animal soul is not operating. It's what might, you know, thoughts that might come into your head at other situations, they even if it comes into your head, it gets dismissed immediately, because at this moment, you've come all this way, you're here in Yerushalayim at the Kotel, you're davening, it's a beautiful experience, you can't spend long here, you've got to go home in 2 days' time, and you want to get the full thing out of it. You're just not interested in any of the negative issues that might be around. Now, so a Beinoni, if he's inspired all the time, is a little bit like a tzaddik. So you could have a person who hasn't actually transformed his or her animal soul, but they're in a state of constant inspiration because either they are davening, which is very inspiring, or they're studying Torah, which is very inspiring, or they're doing a mitzvah, which is very inspiring. Whatever they do, they're excited and enthusiastic about it, and it's just a wonderful experience, making Shabbat, or making this, or making a sukkah. The whole time, they're just excited with a kind of, you know, like pure excitement. And that tips out the Yetzer Hara.
Is that because the intermediate soul is in gear?
You mean the Nefesh HaSichlit, the intellectual soul? The intellectual soul is really a vehicle. It's an instrument. So we can use the intellectual soul to turn us on this way or that way.
Is that what you just described?
No, I'm speaking about either the animal soul or the divine soul. I'm leaving out the intellectual soul. The intellectual soul is another category which is part of the picture, but it's neutral. You can use it either way.
So did you not just describe where you kind of put the animal soul into overdrive, where you kind of...
You're overriding it.
It's inert. It goes inert. The animal soul in a tzaddik, or in a Beinoni who's inspired, and in a tzaddik, one kind of tzaddik, all the time, the animal soul is inert, and he just doesn't notice things that other people would notice as, you know, something with cupidity or some kind of thing. He doesn't notice at all. It's just not there. That's not his issue.
But that's not reality, because that guy, I'm sure, would get hungry at some point.
Well, you see, Tanya quotes that in the name of Hillel, yeah. Who says in the Talmud, I'd better go and look after my poor, forsaken one. Who's his poor, forsaken one? It's his body. Yeah. Now, let me give a description. Getting hungry means the person feels hunger. Mm. But what happens if you're driving and you look at the dial and you say, oh, this car needs petrol? You don't feel anything that the car needs petrol. You worked it out. You can see the dial is approaching the red. You need petrol. It's not a feeling that's driving you. It's just your seichel is saying, if we don't get petrol, the car's going to run out of petrol, then we'll be in trouble. Hillel looks at his body. He says, look, 9 hours have gone since I had a meal. I better have a meal. You know, his passion is for learning Torah. His passion is not for food. Should he give his spiritual passion away to a bowl of porridge? You know, so, but he works out. I'm a human being, and in order to live, I've got to eat. And it's so and so long since I lost that. So let's see. So there's that. So it's a way of relating to the physical world where you turn on at the appropriate time when necessary. Yeah. Now, there are other aspects of life where desire is part of the dimension. And then comes Torah and says that desire is part of what Torah is all about. You know, so for example, if we go back to food, eating on Shabbat, where Shabbat eating is something very special. In fact, it tells the story, a person who witnessed her, Sarah Schneer, the founder of Beis Yaakov, that the way she used to eat on Shabbat, she would be with the girls and she would eat, and every mouthful she had, you know, she would say, the shame covered Shabbat. So the whole time, it was like, it's delicious food, but for the covered of Shabbat. So that concept of the covered of Shabbat. But it's a very reasonable question, the reality of these categories. Avalat tzaddik. So this is about 7 lines down. Avalat tzaddik. But someone who's a tzaddik, nikra eved Hashem b'shem HaTorah, he is called a servant of God, like a noun, kamo shem chacham, a wise person, or a melech, or a king. Shekvar na'aseh chacham, or a melech. He's already become a wise man or a king. Kach zeh, thank you very much. Kach zeh kvar avad v'gama legamri avodat hamilchama emara. He has completed the whole struggle with the evil. Ad ki v'yugar sheyu v'yelech lo, till he's driven it out. V'libo chalal b'kibo, and his heart is absolutely empty as regards that thing. He is not attracted by the desire for some kind of food, whatever it might be. There's a higher level in the tzaddik, incidentally, which he doesn't refer to here, but he does earlier in the book, that he not only neutralizes the animal soul, he transforms it, which means that the energy in the animal soul becomes a positive energy. It's not a force for negative things, it becomes a force for positive things. So that's a whole different ballgame. So now we come, in other words, we're not talking about the tzaddik. We're talking about the Oved Elokim or Lo Avodo. And that person, like the Gemara says they are both tzaddikim, but he has brought it down to the Beinoni. Or the Beinoni, the intermediate person, the person who is actually still in the middle of struggle. He's still in the middle of struggle. Yesh gam kein shtei madrigot. He's also got two levels. Oved Elokim ba'asher lo avado, the one who serves God and the one who doesn't serve God. Ve'af ha'bichein eino rasha. And even though he doesn't serve God, he's not a rasha. Okay, this is what intrigued the Talmud. How can you not be a rasha? How can you be someone who doesn't serve God and be called a tzaddik? And so here he's being called a beinoni. He never transgressed since becoming a Beinoni. He never transgressed the lightest transgression. He kept all the commandments that it's possible to keep, and especially studying of Torah. His mouth never stopped studying. He's a masmid, he's all the time learning and writing chidushim and doing this and doing that. So what's the problem? How can you say he's not serving God? Elu she'eino oseh shum milchama im hayetzel lenatzcho. He doesn't carry out any battle with his yetzer, with his evil desire to conquer it. How would he carry out a battle? Al yedei or Hashem, through arousing a divine illumination, Hameya al nefesh elokit shebemoach, which shines on the divine soul in the brain, Hashalit al alev, which rules the heart canal. There's a concept, moach shalit al alev, the mind rules the heart. And if you have a battle with your heart, what you've got to do is arouse the mind, and the mind will get all enthusiastic, and then it'll be able to percolate down to the heart. Now, why doesn't he have a battle? Mipnei she'ein yitzcho omed lenegdo klal. Because his evil desire does not stand against him, levatlo, to take him away, mitorato, from his Torah study, v'avodato, and the service that he's doing, the mitzvahs he's doing. Ve'ein tzarech lilchom imo klal. He doesn't have to battle with it. How can that be? Kogon shehu matmid b'limudo b'tivo. For example, he's someone who just likes sitting and learning Torah. There's a masmid, one kind of masmid. He sits and learns Torah, but in fact, he's so interested to hear what's going on over there and what's going on over here, and then someone told him there was going to be some event this evening. So the whole time there's a whole lot of things which are around ready to distract him. But he forces himself to sit studying that page of Gemara, and he's going to learn it, and the Rashi, and the Tosfot, and everything else, and the Rishonim, and so on. Even though he is actually keeping away a whole lot of attractions, and he's got a whole lot of friends, and they're all very close to each other, but he is sitting now focusing on the Gemara. But then you have someone who's a completely different type. He's matmid b'limudo b'tibo b'toldato. He is a matmid in study, of Torah study, by nature, from birth. Al yedei tigboret ha-mara shchora, because he's got a very strong dose of mara shchora, melancholy. He's antisocial. If you're antisocial, you've got far less attractions taking you away from the page of Gemara. You're perfectly happy to sit at the page of Gemara. You don't want to talk to those people anyway. That's, you don't want to be disturbed. I knew a man, lovely old gentleman, he used to sell etrogim. So I will come to him to buy an etrog. And I'm looking at the etrog, you know, to see if there are any spots. And he would say in Yiddish, "Pitz tichob, make yourself nicer. What do you care about the etrog? This etrog is good enough for you." It's a very sharp person. So he went to the Rebbe and said he's got a problem with his mara shchora. He's so melancholy and negative. So the Rebbe said, use it in learning Torah. The Rebbe didn't attempt to change him, but just channel it into learning Torah. So you're antisocial, good, okay, you'll have more time to learn Gemara and other things. So that's one thing. So third line down, there's the Tigboret HaMara Shchora, which enables him to study Torah the whole time. V'chein ein lo milchama mitavat nashim. He's also got no battle with desire for women. Why not? Because he's cold by nature. He's cold by nature. Other people are, you know. But no, he is a cold person. He just doesn't notice. Thank you. Similarly, all pleasures of the world. The new laptop, the new iPhone, means nothing to him. Doesn't notice. That's this kind of car, that kind of car. He lacks the feeling of pleasure by nature. And therefore, he doesn't have to contemplate so much the greatness of God. In order to give birth through his contemplation, Ruach Dat v'Yirat Hashem, a spirit of knowledge and awe of God b'mocho in his mind, lehishamer, which will make him careful, shelo la'avol mitzvot lo ta'aseh, so that he won't transgress any negative commandment. So that's So the awe of God, which he provokes by his contemplation, keeps him away from breaking any negative commandments. Va'avat Hashem b'libo, and the burning love of God in his heart, which he achieves through contemplation, l'dovka bo, to cleave to God, b'kiyum ha-mitzvot b'talmud Torah k'neged kulan, inspires him to keep mitzvot, and especially to study Torah, so he's doing things, what he should be doing, what a person should be doing, Rabbi Schneur Zalman is saying, is he should be going the extra mile, he should be doing extra in one way or the other through the battle which causes this tremendous enthusiasm and excitement. Not that he's just coldly doing everything he's supposed to do and not doing the things he's not supposed to do.
Yeah.
But this person who is cold, Eiladailo ba'ava musuteret, for him, you see, inside every Jew there's the idea that there is a hidden love, Asher b'lev klalut Yisrael, which is in the heart of every Jew, shenikru oved shemo, who are called the lovers of God's name, v'lechein eino nikra oved klal, and therefore he is not called a servant of God at all. Ki ahava zu hamasuteret, because this hidden love, eina pu'ulato v'avodoto klal, that's not his work, his service, that's something that everyone has got. And this person who knows Torah and he knows Svarim, he should be working on himself to get this intensity of excitement and enthusiasm. Elehi Yerushateinu Mavoteinu, it's an inheritance from our ancestors, Lichlal Yisrael, for the Jewish people, Ukmosh Katuv, Likaman, as we'll write later on.
So this is like spiritual autopilot. He's on spiritual autopilot.
Yeah. I mean, it's not that he doesn't, have the right kavanah. He takes everything seriously.
Yeah.
But he's not doing anything.
He's not struggling. It's good, yeah.
Now, it's a very interesting thing, because if someone's not struggling, a very normal and conventional Jewish way of looking at, well, you know, he's had a wonderful mandraka. He naturally is a masmid. You know, this person, when he's in yeshiva, the Rosh Yeshiva said, you know, this is one of my top bochurim. He's a natural masmid. The other guy, oh, he's always on the mobile phone. Koim he gets through learning what he's supposed to learn. So the Rambam should really have brought this along as well. The Rambam in Shmona Prakim, which is the Rambam's introduction to Pirkei Avot, discusses the two positions of the person, the person who's got a struggle to serve God, and the person for whom it comes naturally. And what the Rambam says is that from the point of view of the philosophers, like virtue ethics, it's better not to have a struggle. You just do it naturally. Yes, Aristotle's idea that you're naturally doing the right thing, their concept, the right thing is. But you're naturally doing it. Whereas the Rambam says, from the Jewish point of view of the sages, it's better to have a struggle. And then he somehow puts the two together in an interesting way.
Is that because it's possible to tick all of the Talmud mitzvahs and still not actually do anything about elevating one's mitzvahs?
Yes. Yeah. I think that's a very good way of putting it. You see, elevating one's mitzvahs is a kind of a constant problem that we might have. And it's not, since most of the mitzvot, virtually all of them, are about practical things. I mean, even Ahavat Yisrael, where you could say, well, it's an emotion, but it's an emotion that has to be expressed in a practical way. And just having the emotion of Ahavat Yisrael and not doing anything about it, that's not enough as far as the mitzvah goes. But when you talk about tikkun amidot, then that's a very important area, that the person is supposed to have pure, refined midot, and we need to do something about that in order to achieve that.
You need to sweat the big stuff.
You need to sweat
the big stuff.
Yeah. But doesn't the Sefer Chinuch hold that the point of mitzvahs is to refine our character? So surely just by doing mitzvahs, equals I'm going to have a more refined character.
Well, that, he takes that from the Rambam, and the Rambam gets from the Gemara, and the whole point of mitzvot is l'tzaref et habriyot, in order to refine people. That's true. The question is, let's say if you look at the Shulchan Aruch of Rabbi Yosef Karo, does it mention it?
And, but he's going to talk about Hergel Nesa Keteva, right, which is the famous principle of Sefer Chinuch in the next two or three lines.
All right, let's have a look at that. Yeah, but that is Hergel Nesa Keteva. Practice become that what you train yourself becomes second nature.
Yes,
it's still about something practical.
Yes,
the idea of the mitzvot refining you is something internal. Something internal, and then you meet the wonderful problematic viewpoint that the Jewish philosopher Solomon Maimon describes. He left the Hasidic community or the area of Hasidim at Nagdim in Eastern Europe, and he went to Berlin and became a famous philosopher. Kant said he was the only person who understood him. So he then later on wrote an autobiography, and the autobiography describes how he and his friend, they're probably quite young men, young married men, 15, something like that, and their wives at 13. I mean, this was the 18th century after all. So they would, instead of going to Daven, they would go to the wall of the little town and they would walk around the wall together. And everyone, you know, their wives would think they were in shul, and actually they were talking about Mori Nebuchim, about this and about that. And they came to the conclusion, since the point of the mitzvah is to refine people, and we are refined, we don't have to do mitzvah. So it tips over. Yeah, so you have a strong emphasis, on the contrary, you've got to do the mitzvah, whereas the idea of the mitzvah having a refining quality is another dimension. All right. V'chein af mi, now here we have this Hergel Nesa Keteva. V'chein af mi she'enu matmid b'limudo b'tibo. Then you have someone who is not a constant learner by nature. Rak shehigil atzmo lilmod b'hatmada gedola. It's just he's trained himself, or she's trained herself, to learn with great hatmada, with great constancy. V'naseh hegel lo teva sheni, and this has become second nature, as we say in English as well. Teva sheni. Dai lo ba'ava musuteret zu. Making the effort to transform himself, that was very good. So then he's really making the effort. But now he's got there, he's on a kind of plateau again, and he's able to coast along. And so now he only has to run on the hidden love instead of energizing himself with a stronger love. Eilim kein rotzel lilmod yoter meregiluto, unless he wants to learn more than is his custom. And now we come back to the Gemara. Through this, it's understood, Masha Katum be Gemara, the Oved Elokim, that the one who serves God, Hainu Misha Shona Peko Mea Pamim Be'echad, is someone who studies his chapter of Mishnah 101 times. Velo Avodo Hainu Misha Shona Peko Mea Pamim Levad, and the one who doesn't serve God is someone who learns it only 100 times. Vahainu Mishum, and that's because Shibyemeim, in their days, the normal standard was to say each chapter of Mishnah 100 times. As the Talmud explains there, mashal mishuk shel chamarim, a mashal of the donkey, a market, shenischarim le'eser pasi, and you hire them 10 miles, bezuza for one zuza, le'echad azup pasi, and for 11 miles, betray zuzi for the double price. Mipnei shehu yoter miragilutam, because it's more than their custom. V'lechein, now he's explaining. Zod hapam ha'mer v'achat. This 101st time, hayitera ala rigilut, which is that bit more than the normal conventional style, shehu gal min urav, which he was doing from youth, shkula k'neged kulam. That little bit extra That weighs against everything. And is higher than them, v'yeta says v'yeta oz, in a much higher way. And that makes him nikha oved elokim. That makes him be called the one who serves God. Mipnei shekedei l'shanot teva haregilut, in order to change his nature, tzarich l'oreh et ha'ava l'Hashem, he has to arouse genuine love for God. Al yedei shemitbonen begdulat Hashem b'mocho, by contemplating the greatness of God in his mind, lishlot al hateva shevechal al hasmali, to rule over the nature of his heart, in the heart, hamale dama nefesh abahamid, which is filled with the blood of the animal soul, shemea klipa, which is from the concealing force, shememenu hu hateva, and from this comes nature. The nature. And this is a good service for Benini, to arouse oneself, to contemplate, and to fill one's heart with a positive joy and love of God. Or another path, take this hidden love in the heart and coax that into a stronger flame. Limshol al yada al hateva shebechal al hasmali, to rule through it on the nature which is in the left hand part of the heart. Shezunik hagam kein avoda, that's also a style of avoda. So in other words, you're juggling with the love inside you and you intensify the love so that it flows. There's this interesting concept that the love in the right hand part of the heart is something sacred and pure, and the love in the left hand part of the heart is an animal dimension. So the love from the pure right hand side flows into the left hand side and transforms it. And so that also is avodah lehilachem imateva, to battle with one's nature, v'hayetzer, and one's desire, al yedei shema'oreh ha'ava musuteret bilibo, through arousing the hidden love in one's heart. Ma she'en came, which is not the case, because she'en lo milchama klal, if you haven't got any battle at all. Ein ava zu mitzad atzma nikret avodato klal. The love which is there in the right-hand part of one's heart, just because one's a Jewish person and you've had a Jewish upbringing, and so automatically you respond to Shabbat and to davening and to the festivals, but that's just coasting along. You've got to take mastery of yourself, arouse yourself, and become someone who is a much more conscious person. Now, in another chapter of Tanya, he talks about the way that a person who's not a scholar, you know, he seems to be speaking here to a scholar of one kind or another. The person who's not a scholar is in the marketplace, seeing all kinds of very attractive, forbidden things. And he has to struggle with himself. Just to remain an honest Jew, he has to struggle with himself. So he says, so Rabbi Shneur Zalman turns to the reader of Tanya, are you struggling to the same level as that guy? There are all kinds of temptations. One person wants to sell him stolen goods. Another one wants to deal in drugs. Then there's girls. Then there's this. That. And the man, he's got this struggle, and he's trying to live an honest life and not get involved in any of these things. So Rabbi Shneur Zalman says to the scholar, are you making any kind of comparable effort? Okay, no one tries to offer you to sell to buy drugs, but when you pray, are you putting that effort into your prayer the same way that the man who is there in the marketplace has to struggle just to keep a basic level of morality? Are you putting that, when you say v'ahavted Hashem Elokecha, it's something that you mean and it's in your heart? So that's...
Can I just ask you, always when I learn this piece of Tanya, I'm always fascinated from a medical perspective, what's the difference between the right chamber of the heart and the left chamber of the heart? Is there any difference because one's pumping in, one's pumping out? I'm not clear about this, and whether it has how it can be applied here.
The right is the receiver, the right. Left is the giver.
Right. Because it's interesting just the way he associates the right with being, so to speak, the pure one and the left one.
Well, don't
you said the left is full of. He said the left is full of blood, doesn't he?
Yeah, but first of all, if you're going to look at it from a medical point of view, it's not the heart that feels. That it's the brain that feels.
Yeah, yeah.
The only
thing. No, but I'm just interested.
We associate it with the heart.
Yes.
You know, someone that has a crush on someone, they feel it in their heart.
Yes.
Now, But when we talk in this sort of transferred way from the mind to the heart, there's also the right and the left.
Right.
You know, so however it is biologically,
right.
This I ought to.
So this is almost the glorification of struggle.
Yes.
It's saying, if you ain't...
Rather on the human.
That's right. a very good quote.
Yes. If you ain't struggling, if it isn't difficult for you, or if you aren't working at it, if you're just... I think the phrase that comes to mind is the comfort zone. If you aren't pushing outside your comfort zone, wherever that is, then basically you're not serving Hashem. That's what he seems to be saying. That the avodas Hashem is going out of your comfort zone.
Raymond Foxbrunner is a Chabad Hasid who wrote a PhD about Rabbi Shneur Zalman, and then it was published as a book. It's called Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Yadi. By Foxbrunner. Very interesting book. And he, in the introduction, he describes the Greek view of the goal of life. Serenity. And he says the Jewish view, certainly the Hasidic view, is completely different. Struggle, effort.
But it's only for the Beinoni. For the Tzaddik, it's not a struggle, am I right?
Well, the Tzaddik has a different struggle. The struggle of the tzaddik is everyone else. His job is to elevate the rest of the world. What Noach would have done if he would have been the right kind of person,
right,
and being told that there's going to be a flood, he would say, right, I've got 120 years to make sure the world is transformed and then there won't be a flood.
Right.
But instead of that, he just made his own...
right.
So, how would that lead into maybe a more... descriptive terms and work would be labour.
Right. Labour.
Just to labour.
Well, the Yiddish word is horoven.
Horoven. Yeah, the horoven can be very cerebral.
Right.
Horoven. But the psychotherapeutic word is work. A person has to do work on themselves. You know, that the therapy concept is work.
Just talking, I know we've finished now, but just talking about, because Natan's speaking about the Ramchal, and something I found very interesting, by the way, my son in Ramana lives on Ramchal Street.
Houses there more expensive than
ours? No, I don't think so. I don't think it's a cachet thing or wrong, but it's just, it's interesting. I have never seen anywhere in any Hasidic literature of Chabad that the Ramchal is quoted. At all, not in any of the Rebbeim, and even though the last Rebbe also, you know, was such a kolbe, you would think that he would allude to the Ramchal, and I've always been fascinated why there's no mention of Ramchal, and I just wondered whether you have a perspective on it.
Okay,